What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Between the Tackles podcast. As always, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Leave us a 5-star rating. Give us a comment. Interact with us. We love interacting with you. It goes a long way in helping us continue to grow our platform. We're on X, TikTok, Instagram, at Tackles Pod, YouTube, at Tackles Pod. If you're only on Facebook, like my mom is, search Between the Tackles. You can find us there, and all the clips, everything shows up there. So like we said, we love your interaction, so please be sure to do it and leave those ratings. I'm back again with my good pal, Manish. Manish, we got a special episode today, don't we?
We do. Well, we are thrilled to have Sports Illustrated senior reporter Albert Breer with us today. You can find Bert's work on SI.com. His Monday morning quarterback column, which is up right now, is the most informative piece of content centering on the NFL every single week of the year. I don't think Bert takes any weeks off. You can also see weekly videos that he posts on SI.com. Listen to his podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if that weren't enough, you get more Breer for your viewing pleasure on NBC Sports Boston. You can hear him on 98.5, the Sports Hub as well. Bert is evidently pawned off his household chores on his kids, which is a veteran savvy move. Welcome to the podcast, Burton.
Yeah. I'm digging out now. I got a lot to make up for the next few weeks. That's for sure.
I'm sure you do. Look, we read your most recent Monday morning quarterback column, and right off the jump, you talk about the Rams' decision to draft Ty Simpson, Alabama quarterback, with the 13th overall pick. I have a sneaking suspicion that you and I are going to disagree on this one, but can you kind of walk us through their thought process, what they liked, and what you personally think about their decision to draft him?
Yeah, I mean, they went into it. Manish, like I think they're in that window now where you're looking for your opportunity to find your next quarterback. And I always think like the mistakes get made when teams have a gun to their head and saying you got to take a quarterback this year, right? Like I think that's how Kenny Pickett winds up going in the first round to the Steelers, right after they lost Ben Roethlisberger. To some degree, I think that was the Patriots with Mac Jones. We need to find one. We lost Tom Brady a year ago, so let's just take the best one that's available to us. Yeah, I think you're a lot better off if you kind of like look at this over like a 3 or a 4 or 5 year window. Like Andy Reid created that sort of window for himself in Kansas City by getting Alex Smith, right? They didn't have to rush anything. And they wind up with Patrick Mahomes. So, Sean McVay did what he always does, which is, about a week after the Super Bowl, dug into the tape. And, he saw, I'd say, a lot of NFL type things from Ty Simpson. And, I think it wasn't necessarily perfect, but, I think that they sort of view, and a lot of people in the NFL view, like playing quarterback as a dying art, in that a lot of the things at the college level are done a lot differently now, where so much is taken off the quarterback. And so when they get to the NFL, to some degree, they have to relearn or learn for the first time the way to play the position the NFL way. And what, Sean saw on tape was a quarterback who was doing that in college. Now, there are a ton of questions. I would 100% agree with anybody who says that. He is not, the size isn't ideal. The arm strength is good, not great. So there's definitely a lot that you have to sort through. He only started 15 games. Like that's a fair knock, but I think they felt like as a timing and rhythm passer, he has some special qualities. And, I think that the standard for that type of player at that position has always been Drew Brees, or at least as long as I've been covering it, has been Drew Brees. And so do you see some of those sorts of things, in the tape? And that's what the Rams really saw in him. And now, they get a chance to develop him for a year or two behind Matthew Stafford before handing the reins over to him.
The counter that I would have, Bert, is that did they do it now? Just given how close they are to being a Super Bowl team, each of the past two seasons they're on the doorstep, and they could have potentially helped Stafford specifically by giving him a pass catcher, or just helped the team in general by going on defense. And as and as anyone who follows the NFL knows, next year's class at quarterback is supposedly much deeper. Who knows how that ultimately unfolds, but clearly highly regarded, much more so than this year. Why not take a stab next year. I know the sentiment is, well, they're not going to be in position at 13 or that high. But I could have said several years ago, you know, the Seattle Seahawks, when they had Russell Wilson, they weren't going to be anywhere close to having a top 10 pick. And then, by the way, Russell Wilson, you know, gets hurt, has a down year. They had traded that pick away, and the Jets ultimately get that pick. And I believe Garrett Wilson was the player. So there's so many variables down the line, whether it's 1 year, 2 years down the line. And when you're on the doorstep of being a Super Bowl champion, why not, with all of the options available at 13, get somebody who can help you today?
Yeah, it's an interesting question for sure. You know, I would say a couple things. Number one, with their other first round pick, I mean, they really made a win now move, right? Like, in going and getting Trent McDuffie to fill what was a significant hole for them at corner. I also think, like, this, you know, to some degree frees you up in how you're looking at your picks going forward. So, like, those picks going forward, I think you kind of see it as, like, we have our quarterback now, whereas, like, I think that would be hanging over your head the next few years, right? Like, it's like, okay, like, how do we get our quarterback? How comfortable are we using our picks as capital? So I think that that's another factor when you look at where they are right now. And I think they do look outside the box with these things. To me, the biggest thing is, like, what you said off the top, though, is it's hard to project them being in a position where they're going to have a chance at one of those elite quarterbacks next year. They only had this pick in the first place because I'd say the Falcons did what was a very Rams favorable trade last year with them. Like, they wind up in the top 15 because that deal was available to them. And so, you know, over the next 2 or 3 years, it's sort of hard to see a scenario where they're going to be picking high enough to get their guy. And so I just think, you know, again, like, I think you kind of get in that window at the end of a quarterback's career, like the Packers were with Aaron Rodgers, right? Or before that, Brett Favre, where it's like, we really got to at least look at this every year. And maybe we'll take one, maybe we won't. But we got to at least take a hard look at this. And I think that's where the Rams were. And so you're in that window where it's like, we're going to take a hard look at finding our next guy. And look, like, I think part of this was the cost of doing the McDuffie trade too, was like, either we take him at 13 or we're not getting him, you know? And because you traded for McDuffie, you don't have that buffer of having the 29th pick. Now your next pick is 61. So, like, you probably aren't getting him if you don't take him at 13. And I think that that was sort of the dilemma there too, was you could have tried to get in a position to take him at a more proper spot, but either that meant, you know, trading down, which, you know, in this year's draft was difficult to do, or trading way up from 61, which would mean giving up a lot of capital to get back in a position, which may sort of defeat the purpose, you know, of not taking him at 13.
Well, let's just take the Rams out of the equation and just look at Simpson. You know, Bert, you're fully aware Bill Parcells thinks you should start for 3 years, maybe have, you know, 30 some odd starts.
100%.
You know, he's got half that. And when you look, since 2006, there have been 9 first-round quarterbacks with fewer than 20 career starts. And of those 9, I would say one had a pretty good career in Cam Newton, and one has had a passable career to this point in Kyler Murray. But after that, you're talking about Mitch Trubisky, Trey Lance, you know, Mark Sanchez, guys like that. Do you personally see a path for Ty Simpson to be a productive starter in this league, whether it's 1, 2, 3 years down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's – I mean, look, like, you know, the name I heard him compared to the most was Brock Purdy. And that's not going to excite people. But Brock's a really good quarterback, you know, and I don't think Brock gets near the amount of credit that he deserves – because he doesn't have, he's not Superman like Josh Allen or Patrick Mahomes. You know what I mean? Like, but he's an efficient player. And I think Drew was the same way, you know, like, I don't think Drew Brees got nearly the credit for being the athlete that he is, you know? I don't think Purdy gets credit for being the athlete that he is. And so this style of quarterback is definitely, a little different, you know, for sure. Here's the 15 starts thing is, to me, like, would be one of my biggest concerns. here's why I think the 25 starts has become the standard. And then I'll give you what the Rams' reasoning is on this, right? 25 starts is the standard for a lot of NFL people because it's the accumulation of experiences and the accumulation of things you've seen, right? And so if you've started 2 or 3 years in college, what ends up happening is, you know, defenses build a book on you, and then they attack you, and then you've got to counter that. And then they learn how to force you to play with your play to your weaknesses. And then, like, NFL people get to see you playing to your weaknesses, right? And so, like, there's this cat and mouse game that happens in football, which really develops the quarterback because he's got to, like, round out his game and learn to do different things. And he has all these different experiences of seeing all these different defensive structures and all these different rush plans and all of that different stuff, you know? And so, like, you know, a guy like Purdy, for example, who started 4 years at Iowa State, by the time he got to the NFL, he hadn't seen a lot of, like, it's not like he'd seen NFL defenses, but, man, he had seen a lot of different coverages. He'd had to adjust a lot. He'd had, you know, teams get a beat on what he is and then have to adjust to that. Like, there's all of that different stuff. So there are a couple of things here. I think one was the general sentiment from people who like Ty Simpson, and then I'll give you the way I think the Rams saw it. The general sentiment was, and this was what Ty would tell people in the meetings, was, I practiced against a Nick Saban defense for 2 years in college. So for 2 years, my practice experience might have been more difficult than the game day experience for some other quarterbacks, right? Which is like, it's couching it, right? But, I mean, if you've heard about how Nick Saban's teams at Alabama practice, there might be some merit to that. And then I think the Rams' logic was, so in those 15 games, they felt like they saw more things that translated to the NFL that you might see in 30 or 40 starts from another player. And because he was responsible for redirecting protections, he was responsible for changing the play at the line. They could tell watching him play that he was going to the line with multiple plays. He was being forced to see to read things out and work through progressions. And the amount of control he had, the amount they put on his shoulders, was just greater than you would see with most other college quarterbacks. So they felt like, yes, there is this issue of starts, but we're seeing more in those 15 starts than we see with a lot of other players and a lot more starts. And then there was this little nuance that I found fascinating. So in their 10th game, they played against Oklahoma. Oklahoma's coach, Brent Venables, one of the best defensive coaches at the college level, maybe one of the best defensive coaches in all football the last 20 years. He was the DC at Clemson when they were winning national championships. And from what I understand, Brent Venables found a flaw in Alabama's empty protection that basically turned Alabama on its head. So everyone was copycatting it the rest of the year. And so over and over and over again, and this is an Alabama team that did not run the ball very well, right? So his running game's gone and his protection is crumbling. And now all of a sudden, he's got to play sped up the rest of the year. Now he gets hit a lot. Now he gets hurt. Now he's got to play through injury. And so seeing him go through that also sort of accelerated the way they looked at him. So I think, like, there's all of these things that kind of came together that made them a little bit more comfortable. And I think, honestly, Manish, it's going to be a great test of, okay, like, is the 25 start standard, is that hard and fast, or can you make some exceptions to it in cases like this one?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. Something that had learned from reading what you wrote today, I did not realize that he had full field progressions and reads. That's a very rare thing, as you know. You know, when I think of that, talking to NFL people throughout the years, Andrew Luck jumps to mind. But by and large, these guys are not reading the full field coming out of college. It speaks to his intellect and his processing ability, which, you know, as you said, that can go a long way. Maybe that ultimately trumps just the, you know, the raw number of starts that he had. It'll be interesting, be fascinating. To me, it was the most interesting part of day one of the draft.
Yeah, for sure. And again, like, you know, the funny thing about this is this becomes such a yes or no thing. You know what I mean? Like, I just think I mean, look, like at the end, we can talk about this till we're blue in the face. The reality is, if Ty Simpson is still the Rams quarterback in a decade, then like then it's a enormous success getting him at 13. And if he washes out, then they're going to get crushed for taking him. You know what I mean? Like, so it's just at that position, it becomes such a yes or no thing, you know? Like, the Jets are a great example. Like, Sam Darnold, like, I think it's such a shining example of environment. You know what I mean? Like, they take Sam Darnold third overall. Now it looks like they were right. You know what I mean? Somebody told you
they were right 10 years ago. Somebody who
was But they were crushed in the moment for taking that guy. You know what I mean? They were crushed in the moment when Sam Darnold was traded to Carolina. Like, man, they were off. They got it wrong in a draft that had Josh Allen and Lamar. And you'd still rather probably have Josh Allen or Lamar Jackson, but like, history's told us they're not as they weren't nearly as wrong as everybody thought they were in 2021 when they were trading him to Carolina. And so, like, I think that's part of it too, right? The Rams aren't putting this kid in a bad environment. They're not going to shove him out on the field before he's ready. And, you know, in all likelihood, when he gets going, he's probably going to have, you know, a good ecosystem, to borrow the Rams word, around him. You know, he'll have, in all likelihood, still have Puka Nacua as his number one receiver. You know, he'll have, in all likelihood, a really good offensive system and a good offensive staff that he's working with. And, you know, he's walking in. It's not just McVay. You know, he's walking into a situation now where he has three former, like major conference college quarterbacks coaching him, and Cliff Kingsbury, Nate Shielhas, and Dave Ragone. And two of those three played in the NFL.
I want to push this along now. We'll get away from the Rams, but I want to talk about Manish's favorite team, the Philadelphia Eagles. Kind of a unique situation with the trade that came about with the Minnesota Vikings and Jonathan Greenard, with the Vikings not having a GM. So I wanted to get your insight as to how that trade came together. Was it a Kevin O'Connell decision solely, or mainly, I should say, or were there other people inputting there, and how did it come together?
I would just say, like, this is sort of typical of like the way contract negotiations go sometimes. And I think now what ends up happening, and this is, I mean, good for the players for doing this, you know, but I think more often than not, when you look at player contracts now, if you're a fan, you want to circle where the guaranteed money ends, you know. And Jonathan Greenard signed a 4-year deal with the Vikings in 2024. You know, there was 2 years fully guaranteed, which is the way a lot of these deals are. And so he gets to the end of the guaranteed portion of his deal and looks at it and says, well, I want a raise. The Vikings wanted to keep him on the current terms. It was $20 million non-guaranteed this year, $20 million non-guaranteed next year. But they said to him, like, look, like, if there's a team out there that is willing to give us a day two pick and give you the raise that you want, then we'll really think about that, you know? And so they were able to, in the end, find a team that was willing to give him the raise he wanted, which he had $40 million over the next 2 years, non-guaranteed left. He's now getting $50 million over the next 2 years, and all of it's guaranteed on top of, you know, the two non-guaranteed years he now has in the back end of this deal. And the Vikings got not one, but two day two picks. They got a 3 this year and a 3 next year. Now, the 3 this year was the very bottom of the round. But, you know, having the extra capital of a third round pick next year and what's expected to be a historic draft, like, I think the Vikings did pretty well. And obviously the Eagles, you know, their intention was to try to get Jalen Phillips signed to a long-term deal before the bidding got out of control there. So, you know, they bring in a pass rusher, you know, at roughly what they were willing to pay Phillips, you know, for a price, and, you know, what was a comp third round pick, and then a third round pick they'll probably be able to replace next year with the comp pick that they'll get for Phillips.
Interesting. Now, another trade that occurred during the draft was with their rival Cowboys trading up to get Mekhi Lemon. So I'm the resident New England Patriots guy here. How does this trade pan out with the rumored, you know, expected to be done on June 1st trade of A.J. Brown to the Patriots? And what might that trade actually look like now that Mekhi Lemon is in Philadelphia?
I mean, it feels like the breadcrumbs are all over the floor right now. It's just like, the Patriots do not take a receiver in the draft period, right?
Yep.
And then the Eagles, who have already traded for Dontayvion Wicks, who've already signed Elijah Moore, who've already signed Hollywood Brown, now trade up to get Mekhi Lemon. I mean, at some point, you're going to run out of seats in the receiver room. And like, I mean, I feel like the music stopped and A.J. Brown's still on his feet. You know what I mean? Like, so I would say the likelihood is that he gets traded to New England. I think one of the reasons that they leave this open, right? And I think this is why you can't really push these things over the goal line. You can't, I mean, first of all, just to be clear, like you can't like draft a player for someone else, right? Like they have to be future picks. You can't draft a player for someone else and then make that player just sit for the next month waiting to get to his new team. It just doesn't work in the NFL. You know, the other piece of it, and the reason why it's really hard to come to an agreement beforehand is, well, what if some receiver that the Patriots really like slipped to 31? What, are they not going to take him now? You know what I mean? Like, are they not going to do that because they have this wink, wink, nod, nod agreement with Howie Roseman? And then on the flip side, let's say some contender in May has, or, you know, a receiver who has like a freak ACL or something like that in OTAs or working out or whatever it is. And now, you know, you've got like a desperate team out there that might want to jump in on the bidding. You know, the Eagles wouldn't want to close the door to that. So, you know, I think there's been good dialogue between the teams. My guess is it gets done, but you know, there are some wrinkles with the way this can take place. Certainly all their actions, the actions of both the teams, tells you it's going to happen.
Would you say that one team has more leverage over the other, given that the draft is passed and moves are being made? Because it seems like I said, like this trade just won't go away, and it's just almost, it's done, but it's not done.
I mean, like there's pressure on New England to do it now because it's out there, right? Like, so I guess like with everything happening with that organization right now, like that there is a little bit more public pressure to get this thing done. For the Eagles, it would be awkward trying to bring him back at this point, I think, you know? So is, you know, can you repair the relationship between AJ and Jalen Hurts? Like it kind of feels like that ship has sailed. I think it would be a tough look for both teams if it doesn't get done. But like I said, like you could get like that, yeah, just something weird happening, you know, over the course of the next 3 or 4 weeks that changes the dynamic.
What do you think the compensation is going to be, Bert? I mean, let's be honest here.
Yeah.
Like you know, the teams have essentially outlined the parameters of a deal.
Yeah. So like, I think like if you're looking at, I know what the Eagles were thinking, which was, you know, Davante Adams is about the same age as A.J. Brown. He went for a 1 and a 2. And then if you look at the Quinnen Williams deal last year, which was, you know, A.J. Brown's the same draft class as Quinnen Williams, around the same age, both play premium positions. The Jets got a second this year and a first next year. So both those deals are for a 1 and a 2. I think, you know, the flip side, the way other teams looked at it was like, no, this is because of the injury situation, a little bit more like Stephon Diggs, and not the first trade from Minnesota to Buffalo, but the second trade from Buffalo to Houston, which was basically for a second rounder and change. So how do you bridge that? Well, two things I think there. Number one, I don't think Howie Roseman's going to do a deal where he doesn't come out looking like the winner, right? So that's number one. Number two, I know Howie has been creative in getting there. And so, you know, I think about the Carson Wentz deal and how, like, I'll raise my hand and say I thought there was no way he was going to get a first-round pick for him, right? But they were able to put conditions on the trade. And so like that became a two, conditionally could become a one. It did become a one. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if there were conditions on the deal. The other, like the other thing there and the other creative thing they can do is push some of the picks into the future, which I know some of the previous trade talks on this were involving not a 2027 first round pick, but a 2028 first round pick. And Howie's shown a willingness to do that too, in that the Hassan Reddick trade, they just used, I want to look this up, but that Hassan Reddick draft pick was in this year's draft, which was, I mean, that pick was, and hang on one second, I'm going to tell you, that might have been, it might have been the Reddick pick that went to, Manish, you might have followed this closer than me. Now, I wish I had looked this up, but the Reddick pick, I believe, was the one that they sent to
Minnesota?
I think so, but I'd have to look this up.
It's the 68th overall pick.
Okay, so, all right. So it was the 68th one, yeah. So they wind up getting Markel Bell with that pick, right? Because they were willing to push it down a year. And I would argue that having that pick was what helped free them up to use the other three to go get Jonathan Grenard. So Howie's never been afraid to get like, hey, if I want to get real value, I'm not afraid to take that value a year later, which I think is one of the advantages that somebody like Howie has because he has job security. There are a lot of guys who aren't as willing to do that because it's like, well, like it might be somebody else making that pick by the time we get there.
So it could just mirror the Quinnen Williams deal. Essentially, pushing it back a year, so 2027 second-round pick and a 2028 first-round pick. Is that?
Yeah, and then maybe you put a condition on one of those. Like maybe it's – I think the Wentz deal, if I remember right, wasn't it two twos and then one of the twos could become a one?
I believe so, yes.
Right? So like I wouldn't be surprised if it was something like that. Look, like I think it's also kind of like relative to how you view A.J. Brown, you know. And there was a real split on that. Like there are some people that I know some teams didn't like his scans, which, you know, that was the history of it. If you want to go back, like the reason the Titans traded him in the first place is because their doctors basically said his knee wasn't going to hold up, so you shouldn't sign him to an extension. And Mike Vrabel knows that because he was there for that, you know? So, you know, like, I think there's like a little bit of a split here in the way people look at this and that, people I've talked to and assessing what AJ is at this point, you know, on the doorstep of turning 29 and going into his eighth year in the NFL, is, you know, half the people think he's starting to break down physically, and bigger receivers tend to lose it fast. Julio lost it fast. Andre Johnson lost it fast. Larry Fitzgerald's really the outlier there. And then the other half of the people I've talked to were like, no, he just seemed disinterested last year because of his frustration over where the offense was.
Yeah, and I want to piggyback on that, Bert. Is it as simple as A.J. Brown does not believe in Jalen Hurts as a quarterback? Because if you talk about his frustration where the offense is, it's a completely different offense with Sean Mannion coming in. He doesn't know Sean Mannion. So why still this urgency to leave? Does he just think that Hurts isn't good enough?
Yeah, it's a frustration with where Hurts is. Like, I think, you know, I remember saying this about Brady at the end of his career and at the end of his time in New England. And I think at one point he said, I'm the most miserable 8-0 quarterback of all time. And like, I remember him saying that. And I remember making the point then that you can't expect these guys who are like high level competitors to be competitive about team performance, but not individual performance. And these guys all deep down in their gut care about their legacy. They care about how they're remembered. They care about, you know, whether or not they get in the Hall of Fame. And so, you know, I do think A.J. Brown is hyper competitive about his individual performance. And his individual performance has not been as good as it was his first 2 years in Philly. And so, you know, I think frustration can boil over that way. And I do think there's been a lot of like the palms up with him after like feeling like Hurts wasn't getting deep enough in his progression or didn't see the coverage right. And like, he felt like the ball should have gone to him. So I think it's just like an accumulation of all of those different little things happening where it's, I not only want to go to a place where I can win and he's in a place he can win now. I want to go to a place where, you know, there's going to be, I'm playing with a quarterback who's going to maximize me.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it and I've watched every snap in the last 4 years or whatever it was, and I just think it comes down to he doesn't think that Jalen Hurts can get him
right
to where he wants to go. Whereas, you know, you're the one who outlined, yes, the four teams that that he was interested in being traded to. All those teams have, you know, legit, what I call legit quarterbacks, you know, Justin Herbert, Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, and even Drake May. It's funny as that sounds, he's a young
player. And when the Eagles opened it up to at least listening to NFC teams, like that was, I mean, Rams and Matthew Stafford.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So yeah,
real quarterbacks, as I like to refer to them. But that's a different discussion. I want to get your thoughts on this two-parter on Mike Vrabel. He was open at the combine, saying that he does have dialogue with AJ Brown. You know, they talk about personal things of that nature. But the admission that he had, and perhaps still has, ongoing dialogue with a player on another team, isn't that clear grounds for fining? And I'm saying this because in 2015, the Jets owner, Woody Johnson, said something fairly innocuous. He said that he would love to have Darrelle Revis, who was then technically still a member of the New England Patriots, back in free agency. And the Jets got fined $100,000 for that. In this particular case, it seems even more explicit that the head coach is saying that, yeah, I'm communicating with this player throughout the season when he is a member of the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't the Patriots get punished for that?
Because they're allowed to have personal relationships with the guys. And I think, you know, there's an obvious, like there's the obvious there, which they spent 3 years together. They were very close through that time. And like, there's nothing preventing a guy from having a conversation. How are the kids? You know, how's everything going? But here's the problem, right? Like, and I know why you guys are laughing, right? Like, but the problem is that if you're going to ding them for that, now you've opened Pandora's box. And now if you're the league and you're investigating something that you didn't, that there's never been like proof or anybody say that conversation was about him joining the New England Patriots, right? Now, logically, can we all deduce like it may have come up? Yeah, sure, we can. But does the NFL really want to be like digging into every personal conversation that every coach has with one of his former players? That's the issue. So I think because of that, you sort of need proof on the front end. Like what Woody said was specifically about Darrelle Revis joining the Jets, right? Which you can't do. We don't have proof that the conversation, even though like logically you can look at it and say, of course, you know what I mean? We don't have any proof that that's what happened. Like, again, like I think it becomes an issue for the league where it's like we just can't police everyone's personal relationship with their former players.
Okay. Well, I'm going to,
it's like a legit, like, again, I get the logic, but it's more of like a, like it's weird to say this, but they almost like more of a logistical thing than anything, you know, like I don't want to dig through 100 different people's text messages.
I understand that, but you know, given what's come to light over the last several weeks, I'll use the transitive property here for proof. If I'm stating a case that there was obvious discussions about things not related to football, former athletic insider Diana Rossini reported during the season repeatedly that AJ Brown was not happy in his current situation. And given what we know about the relationship between Mike Vrabel and Diana Rossini, I don't think, Bert, that it's really a big leap to think that information conveyed from a private conversation between coach and player was then transmitted to a reporter.
Yeah. I mean, and then maybe you look into that, I guess. I mean, like there's still dot connecting though. You know what I mean? Like as logical as it is, it's still dot connecting where like with what the example you use with Woody is explicit, right? Like it's explicit, like he said it, you know? And what they were trying to prevent with that was now you've opened another door, which is to owners actively, you know, like recruiting players outwardly that aren't on their teams, which And you think about that part of it, right? Like, which it can create issues with other organizations, you know, like, oh, well, like that owner wants me now. So, you know, now I've got that in my back pocket. It's just, they're just sort of different circumstances. And I think it like merits a tire kicking? Probably. Yeah. Like, do I think the league wants to get involved in that? Probably not. So.
Yeah, I definitely don't think the league wants to be involved in that. Just going along.
For a number of different reasons.
Yeah. Going along with Mike Vrabel, you know, the biggest football story on day one, as we touched on earlier, I think was the Rams selecting Ty Simpson. The biggest tangential football story was Mike Vrabel saying that he would not be in the war room on day three. You know, you're plugged in as much as anybody in you know, covering NFL football on the New England Patriots. What do you think this means for Vrabel moving forward? Do you think there'll be an extended absence, you know, during these summer months? Not quiet necessarily months, but yeah. not the hectic months during the NFL calendar. I mean, what's next for him?
I think, you know, I said this on Boston radio last week and it got like, it went nuclear, like everything involving this story goes nuclear. But I do think, you know, there's, for the people inside that building, you know, the last couple of weeks, there's been a little bit of a different version of Vrabel, and he's got such bravado and swagger and all that different stuff that's visible to anybody who's paying attention. When that gets toned down a notch, people are going to feel it. And so, like, if I were the Crafts, what I would do is I would say, go away, go away and don't come back until, like, you feel like you're whole again. Whether that means you've reached closure with your wife that you're getting divorced, whether that means you've mended fences, whatever. We want what's best for you, but we need the full version of Mike Vrabel back. And it's more important that we get back there than, you know, you being at some OTA in May. I just think, you know, I think that piece of it, his personality and his, and look, like, he's really good. Like, he's one of these guys who can coach almost any position. So he's really good with the football stuff, but his ability to galvanize and build relationships and get everyone on board, bring an organization together, I think is as good as it gets in that category in the NFL. And I think if he's not fully himself from a personality standpoint, then you're chipping away at his biggest strength. So I think that would be the biggest thing. If I were them, would be, listen, like, you know, you need to get yourself right. And once you get yourself right, come back. But, like, we don't want to see you until then.
Yeah, it's such a visceral topic. And I did hear what you said, and I knew exactly what you meant as anything related to this topic.
People, it doesn't matter what I meant.
It's like it's really become like politics, right? You can't win. If you talk about politics, you're not going to win. There's always going to be 50% of the people that are going to, you know, lash out at you. I just wanted to ask you journalistically, Bert. I mean, you know this. We've talked about this ad nauseum for, you know, a decade plus. I think you are, you know, now that Peter King is retired, retired, he has a new book coming out. But now that, you know, Peter's not doing the Monday morning
Peter retirement.
Yeah, exactly. You are by far the most plugged in NFL reporter. I know there's a clear difference between insider and what your role is. You are an insider who actually, not to, you know, cast aspersions on anybody else, but you know more than anybody I know covering the league about what's actually happening behind the scenes. So just generally speaking, because there's been stories about, you know, Rossini's reporting dating back to Julio Jones being traded from the Atlanta Falcons to the Titans, how a report that the Falcons were entertaining first-round picks may have scared off other teams and then narrowed the pool for ultimately the Titans to get him for a 2 and a 4. Do you think, practically speaking, that a reporter can influence a trade market in that way?
I hesitate to say yes, because I do think most teams are aggressive enough now. Do I think it can help speed things up if teams know what's truly out there? Sure. I don't know. like you said, like a big part of my job is like I'm information trading, right? Like, and I know more than I report, and you know, so like this is a big time of year. The last 2 weeks, big time of year for me in trading information and trying to figure out what's happening. And I feel like I can help teams with certain things. And it's good that way, because like you ask so much of these people over the course of the year, being able to give back something from an information standpoint is huge. I mean, like I can say that, like, you know, I've talked to teams about trades and about what's out there before, on like something that's hypothetical or hasn't happened yet. In some cases, those trades have gone across the goal line. In other cases, they haven't. It's an interesting thing. I don't know that it's realistic to think that the Falcons in that scenario with an iconic player, right? Like one of the best players in the history of the franchise would just stop making phone calls and take the Titans offer if it wasn't good enough relative to what the rest of the league was asking. So might the idea that first round picks were out there for Julio scare people off? Maybe. Would that prevent you from picking up the phone and calling? Probably not. You know, so again, like I think it can affect the speed with which these things happen sometimes, but I don't know that it could totally derail, you know, trade from happening. I can't imagine. And here's the other thing about that one. Arthur Smith and Mike Vrabel are incredibly close. You know, Arthur Smith, for people who don't know, was Mike Vrabel's offensive coordinator in Tennessee, wound up getting the Atlanta job. So like, I think that relationship being there was probably a much bigger factor than anything, you know, happening between a reporter and a coach. And in that particular instance, I think it was sort of an example of the league being ahead of everybody else. Like, I think people around the NFL saw the wheels coming off, you know, and that's why the Falcons couldn't get more than they did. And I think to some degree, like it, look, like bigger receivers, it happens, right? Andre Johnson lost it pretty quick. You know, he's a great, great receiver, lost it pretty quick. I think Larry Fitzgerald's the outlier. And so that's what's going to be so interesting about this A.J. Brown case is that, like, okay, like, what does this look like now? It's a bigger receiver who's getting older who has injury issues, you know? It'll be fascinating to see how that plays out.
Yeah, that's a good point. Fair point. I agree to you. Agree with you, you know, to a large extent about that. Let's just get back to football and on the field in 2026, 27. Round one of the draft, were there any almost trades that you're aware of? Trade where teams were close to making a deal and it didn't happen for whatever reason.
Yeah, I'm just like looking at like some of this. Like I know, you know, so I think one thing that was interesting is like the teams that were looking to move up, and that was, you know, like I had heard before the draft, the Rams, the Chiefs, the Cowboys, the Rams and the Chiefs and Cowboys, and I think this bared out, was like they were looking at shorter moves up in case somebody fell, right? Like, so I think the Cowboys go up a spot to get Downs. I think if Sonny Styles had slipped past the Commanders at 8, maybe they would have had a conversation going up further. The Chiefs, same thing. Like, they trade up for Delane. Like, I think if Reese had – they didn't want to give up their 2, but, like, Reese was another one where – if he had fallen into 6, maybe they look at it. I think if the Rams had gone up, it probably would have been for Love. So like, there were some of those conversations that were happening. Now the Rams wind up sitting back and taking Ty Simpson where they did. But those were some of the things that you heard there. And I mean, I would say like, it's, and then the Eagles were one where they were fascinating to me because I had heard they were going to go up for a tackle, and maybe they were, but the tackles came off the board so fast, you know, like that. I mean, at the point where, you know, you were getting close, I mean, so at that, like by the time you got to 20, which is the spot the Eagles traded up into, 5 tackles were gone. And, you know, I think the one they may have had circled might've been Caden Proctor. And Proctor went higher than people thought. Like, so he went at 12 to Miami. So You know, some of those things, I think, you know, like there were some moving parts and everything else. And I think some of those trades, some of the potential trades that were out there were predicated on players falling into a certain range, which, you know, the one that actually did happen, the one bigger one that did happen, which was the Chiefs going up with Delaney, that also had some different dynamics because, I mean, you could link that right to Jermaid McCoy's knee injury. And that, like, now instead of there being a 1A and a 1B at corner, there was a very clear number one, you know? And if you didn't get him, maybe you felt like there wasn't a number one corner, a number one type of corner left in the draft, you know? So I think, you know, some of the uncertainty and the volatility of this year's class led to a lot of those discussions because teams wanted to be ready for guys falling.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that the Rams are willing to make a big trade up for a, you know, win now player in Jeremiah Love, but they ultimately drafted.
Yeah, and I think Love was seen as like Love. Like I will say this, like, Jeremiah Love was seen as like a. I mean, this was a. You know, there have been however many of them in the last 13 years. You know what I mean? Like going back to I think what this era of running back is. I think he was the. I want to say he was the eighth running back to go in the top 10 in the last 13 years. And then he was like the sixth to go in the top five over the last 20. And like the more people I talked to, the more people said like, this guy is a, I mean, the Giants, like, I think I said this to you, like he was co-number one on their board among non-quarterbacks. It was Reese and it was Love. They were right there with each other. So the only question with him was the positional value thing. And I think it would have taken Love really slipping. You know, where maybe the Rams felt like they could reposition themselves to get Simpson if they did go up and get Love.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I believe it was Sean McVay's first season as the head coach when Todd Gurley was offensive player of the year for him. I could be off a year or two, but I'm pretty sure that he had Gurley when Gurley was at the end of his peak.
And he saw what Gurley did for a young quarterback. Gurley, it would have been Gurley's third year. And the deployment, I would say, of Todd Gurley in his offense was a massive piece of getting Jared Goff turned around. You know, after Goff had a disastrous rookie year in Jeff Fisher's last year, you know, and they really had to get him turned around. And Gurley was a huge part of helping them do that.
Who would you say is the best pick of day two? Day two. If you had to pick a guy.
So let me pull it up. I'm looking through it. What jumped out at me?
Worst pick too. Who was a reach?
Worst might be harder for me. see, like it's hard this year. Okay, so I'll give you one. And this is probably because, like, he helped his team beat Ohio State, but. D'Angelo Pons, D'Angelo Pons against Indiana was one of my favorite players to watch. The Jets get him at 50. I think Aaron Glenn saw a lot of himself in D'Angelo Pons. And so D'Angelo Pons would be one that I look at and say, like, that guy, like, has a chance to be a really good player in the pros. Maybe not a number one corner, but like an elite slot corner who's tough as hell and all of that. And then I'm just kind of like scrolling down here. You know, it's one, you know, so this is one that I think is really interesting. So the Falcons didn't have a first round pick for what wound up being a disastrous trade last year. But they got Avian Terrell a lot later than people thought he'd be available in the second round. And the guy I liked that they got in the third round, Zachariah Branch, who... Like, this guy's a stick of dynamite with the ball in his hands. And, you know, he's one of these guys that, like, the more I talk to people, the more it's like, Georgia didn't really highlight him. They had a lot of mouths to feed there. And, like, he's going to be a better pro than he was a college player. But you see some of the stuff on him, and it's just, he has a chance to be so electric with the ball in his hands. So I thought the Falcons, for a team that didn't have a first-round pick, and it's not the fault of Matt Ryan and Ian Cunningham and Kevin Stefanski, they weren't there for that trade, but I thought they did pretty well on day two after having to sit out day one.
How about a day three sleeper? Day three.
See, now you're going deep in there. Now I got to I'm not gonna.
You don't have this off the top of your head, Bert.
Dude, I'm not gonna pretend that I was like breaking down the defensive tackle from like southeastern Louisiana. I mean, the easy one for me would be Garrett Nussmeier, and I actually wrote this down last night. I thought this was really interesting. So, do you know Andy Reid? This is only the third quarterback he's taken. While he's been with the Chiefs, right? So he's now been with the Chiefs for as many drafts. This will blow your mind. He's been with the Chiefs now for as many drafts as he was with the Eagles. So this is his 14th draft with the Chiefs. He was with the Eagles for 14 drafts. He's only taken three quarterbacks. It was Aaron Murray in 2014 on day three. It was Patrick Mahomes, which obviously that one worked out okay, in 2017. And then Garrett Nussmeier this year. However, with the Eagles, five quarterbacks after Donovan McNabb, right? So in the 13 years after they took Donovan McNabb, those five quarterbacks, A.J. Feely, Andy Hall is the throwaway, right? Kevin Cobb, Mike Kafka, Nick Foles. Now, you're not saying the world on fire, but that's four really like pretty good NFL players that Andy Reid was able to dig out while having McNabb on his roster, and they were able to trade a couple of those guys. They traded Feely and Cobb and got like a good return for those guys. Foles wound up leaving and coming back and winning a Super Bowl. So like, I love the idea of Garrett Nussmeier, who I think's got a lot of gamer to him, who had an awful year, a terrible year. Last year at LSU, I think there's a good chance that that becomes a nice redemption story, and he has a nice long career. And then just like I'm looking at the names here. You know, one of the guys I really liked watching in college, and this is a need for the Colts because they just got rid of Zaire Franklin, but Bryce Betcher, the former baseball player at Oregon. You know, they drafted C.J. Allen, so they doubled down on the position. They drafted C.J. Allen in the second round. But I think Bryce Betcher has a chance to be a really good NFL player just based on watching him and hearing people talk about him and everything else. Like, I think he'll be one of these guys who, you know, winds up playing 8, 9, 10 years in the NFL as a fourth round pick.
I'll just say, I wish Bill Belichick could have found usable quarterbacks like that in the draft and being able to trade him for something else while he had Tom Brady.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's day three for you. I did. That was not off the top of my head. So
I wanted you to break down the Nigerian that the Eagles drafted in day three or seventh round. Guy, 6% body fat, never played football in his life.
Oh, that guy is interesting. That guy, I remember seeing that. Like, I think Bruce Feldman did a story on him, right? Yeah. He was the one. Where is it? Yeah. Uar Bernard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like he weighed like 306. He like freaking shredded, like unbelievable. Like, it was like how I saw that. I'm like, I don't know exactly how you use that guy, but there's got to be a job for him somewhere on the field.
Yeah, he'll probably take over for Big Dom when Dom retires.
He'd be the first one off. How about this? He'd be the first one off the bus.
Yeah. Bert, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on the two New York teams, specifically. You know, you mentioned Isaiah Pons, clearly a biased choice because he did well against your Buckeyes. But when you look at the Jets draft, you know, they're getting a lot of bouquets. You know, David Bailey, I think, is going to be an exceptional player. I'm not really sold on Kenyon Sadiq. I don't really think they needed that position. Omar Cooper, to me, is going to be a solid number two. I wanted to ask you a specific question because we can talk about the quarterback. They're going to get one next year. But they do play defense in the NFL, and the Jets' defense was absolutely atrocious last year on all levels. If you were going to trade back into the first round and ultimately have three first-round picks, I thought it would have been a great opportunity to get three defensive starters. They ultimately drafted two offensive players and Bailey with the number two overall pick. What do you make of not only the draft, generally speaking, but their defense?
I personally think, I hesitate. This isn't a throwaway year because there are no throwaway years and there are people's jobs on the line. And last year was a throwaway year and they wind up firing 12 assistant coaches, right? So, you know, I just think so much of this has to be about giving ownership hope and giving the locker room hope. you know. And I think for Aaron Glenn and Darren Mooji, that's part of what went into the David Bailey pick. Look, like Aaron Glenn was in Detroit, and what they in Detroit, the first 2 years weren't perfect, but they finished the first year strong, right? Like, so I think they were 0-10-1, and then they finished 3-3. Which is modest, but that's, hey, there's like a light at the end of the tunnel here. And then the second year, they start 1-6, and they finish at 9-8, which was a big step, and we know what's happened since. So comparing that to where the Jets were last year, again, they lose 5 in a row to finish the season, they get blown out by the Bills' backups, and then they fire 12 assistant coaches. So, look, I just think you have to do things to kind of create hope. And David Bailey, to me, was that. Taking him over Reese is a little bit more of, all right, like, this guy is going to, like, when we put this guy in the field, he'll be functional right away. He'll be ready to go right away. And, like, he's going to help us create hope in our locker room. Like, hey, we aren't that far away. And I think you have to keep doing that. You know what I mean? Like, I think you have to keep putting guys in the right. So, to me, it's like a little bit of a, they're still in that, just take the best players, right? Just take who you think the best players are, regardless of position. So they wind up with those 4 in the top 44, which wound up being 4 in the top 50 after the trade down for 44. 2 offense, 2 defense. One thing I do like about where they are offensively right now is they have the shell of something for the next quarterback, right? So you have first round picks at both tackle spots, and Olufashanu and Armon Membu. You have an inline tight end in Mason Taylor as your second round pick last year. You have a move tight end in Kenyon Sadiq. So those guys complement each other as your first round pick this year. You have a legitimate number one in Garrett Wilson, and now a first round pick playing opposite him, and 2 backs, one on the tag in Breece Hall, and another who they really liked before he got hurt last year in Braylon Allen. I don't know if all of those are going to work out, but you have like the shell right now of a group of young players that can grow together for a year and maybe have a pretty good thing going for a young quarterback to step into. And all those guys are still young, so now the young quarterback can grow with all those guys around him. So I think Darren Mooji did a good job of, just kind of sticking to what, like, hey, we think these are the best players. I think Omar Cooper would have been a consideration for them at 16, believe it or not, if Sadiq hadn't been available. At least building something where I think one of the worst things you can do is just put a young quarterback into a startup, right? It's one of the reasons why the Raiders want to play Cousins this year. It's like you get them knocked around, you kill their you don't want to do that. So like there's at least the shell right now of what could be a decent situation for a young quarterback to walk into in 2027 for the Jets.
Will they be, I can't believe I'm saying this, but will the Jets be too good to be in striking distance for one of these young quarterbacks?
I mean, they have the 3 first-round picks. So, you know, I mean, I think the Cowboys and Packers are going to be pretty good. So you're probably – I don't know how high those picks are going to be, but you at least have the 3 first-round picks. It's an interesting question for sure. And, like, I mean, here's the other thing. We don't know for sure about next year's quarterbacks. Like, I'd say the closest thing we have to a sure thing – as in, like, not sure thing he's going to make it in the NFL, but I'm pretty sure he's going to be a top 5 pick would be Dante Moore. Like, I think he's the closest thing. People put Arch Manning on top of these drafts. Maybe he'll get there. He's not there right now, you know? And this is the way that people looked at Caleb Williams at this point in 2023, the way that people looked at Drake May at this point in 2023. Jaden Daniels was sort of a late riser, but people looked at those two, at Caleb and May, as guys a year out, they're going to be in the top 5. Trevor Lawrence, you guys remember that, same sort of thing. Justin Herbert was seen that. We don't really have that. So what we do have is about a dozen quarterbacks with a chance, which is an enormous number. So the more you have like that have a chance at getting there, the better chance that it's going to happen, obviously, right? Like, so like last year, I'd say we had like 4 or like what you say, Nussmeier, Aller, Sellers. Who am I missing? Beck, like maybe, like, and people looked at those guys and it was like, okay, like 2 of these guys have probably hit, and then none of them hit. Right. So like it doesn't mean they're going to be 12 first round quarterbacks, but if there are 12 of them instead of like 4 of them, well, then there's a better chance that maybe 3 become what everybody would hope they become.
real quick on the Jets, and I want to pivot quickly to the Giants. They've got a nice foundation. I agree with you. Darren Mooji, I think, has done a really nice job. He did have to trade away two Pro Bowl defensive players to get some of these assets. But by and large, I think he's done a really good job. And just like on a personal note, I've known Aaron Glenn for a very long time. He's actually a very nice person. And he did not come across that way publicly in his first year for whatever reason. Do you think that Woody Johnson would give Aaron Glenn a little bit of rope? Because there's a segment of the Jet fan. Yeah, there's a segment of the Jet fan base that doesn't want that.
I can tell you this. Like, there are people in Detroit that thought, I mean, like, high up in Detroit that thought Aaron Glenn was going to be a better head coach than Ben Johnson. And the qualities that Aaron Glenn has that made them think that did not go away. So I just think it's going to be on, you know, and again, like, I'm not asking anybody to tolerate 0-17 or like every draft pick doesn't work. I'm not asking you to tolerate that. But, you know, I also think like their expectations need to be realistic, you know, like of where they're going and what they are right now. And, you know, I think 3 years is a fair litmus test, you know, do all these young guys that they brought in develop? And then does the young quarterback look like he's giving you a light at the end of the tunnel at the end of 2027? So I personally, I mean, barring a catastrophe, which I think if it's a catastrophic year, then all bets are off. You know, if they give you some semblance of hope, then I think it makes sense to stick with it for another year, but that's just me.
A few weeks back, you had a sit down with Joe Shane and John Harbaugh. I love what the Giants did in the draft. I have a player question and then a personnel question. There's been a lot of speculation right after Harbaugh got hired whether Joe Shane would be around for the long term. Nobody's going to fire somebody before the NFL draft. What do you think Joe Shane's job security is for the remainder of this offseason? And then secondly, from a player perspective, you know, bringing in Reese, does that really alter their plans for Kayvon Thibodeau? Do you think Thibodeau will be traded, or do you think he'll be on the Giants this season?
I think Joe Shane's good for now. I think the bigger question is like the extension, right? The contract extension. So like, does he get an extension? But I think like the relationship between Joe and John has been good, you know, and my understanding is, and I could see, I mean, look, like I could see the, I'm not carrying anybody's water here. I could see the personal interaction between the two, and I've known both guys for a long time. I could see the personal interaction between the two, and that all looked good to me. I think it's also important to remember these things have worked out in other places. Like Elliott Wolf was there with Gerard Mayo when Gerard Mayo got fired, survives it. They hire a strong head coach in Mike Vrabel. It worked out. In Denver, right? Like George Payton survives the firing of Nathaniel Hackett after the firing of Vic Fangio. A strong head coach and Sean Payton comes in. It winds up working out. You know, so I think you have to be a low ego guy for it to work. And I think Wolf and George Payton are relatively low ego guys, you know, and I think that's why it worked. And I think you see some of that with Joe working with John now. So do I know that Joe Shane is absolutely getting a contract extension? No. But it does feel to me like that new setup with Joe is part of it, and they've made a lot of changes, right? Like, so I can understand why people would have their radar up. I think to this point it's worked out, and we'll see where it goes, and we'll see if it's enough to get him a contract extension. What was the second part of your question? Was this like one of those, this was one of those two part questions. It's actually two questions.
questions under the Giants umbrella, Kayvon Thibodeau, will he be traded?
I sort of feel like with the draft done, maybe the ship has sailed. I think if they had gotten like an offer of like a 3, my guess is they probably would have done it. And again, that's a guess. But I just don't know what his value is to other teams now. You know, I believe they've got to make the decision now. He's on his 5th year option, I believe, this year now. So he's in a contract year, and it'll be interesting to see what happens because, you know, last year he was chiefly like a third down player for them, you know, kind of like a, like, and they mess with that some, but with Arvel Reese coming in, Arvel Reese shit doesn't affect him on early downs, right? Because Arvel Reese is going to be playing off the ball, but on third down, Arvel Reese will affect him. And my guess is you're going to want to have Arvel Reese out there instead of Kayvon Thibodeau. So does this chew into a sack? Does chew into a snap count? And then on top of that, there's also like that piece of it is like, well, if you're cutting this guy's playing time way down, or he's playing a lot less, and now he's in a contract year, do you have a disgruntled player when you're in the first year of your program? And that's something that I think you have to consider when you're looking at all of this.
I want to move it on to the Raiders and a guy you mentioned a little bit earlier, Jermon McCoy. He was taken, you know, we know his injury concerns. He was taken at the top of the fourth round. Where is the real concern from this, from the teams coming from? Because he did run well at his pro day, and it seemed like it kind of came in late. So do you have any inside information?
Yeah, it's not really about the here and the now. Because the here and the now is like he's recovered from the ACL and he ran well and he feels good and he's ready to play, right? Like, so all that is there. This is a longevity question that's similar to the longevity question, but probably a little worse, is Will Johnson last year. And Will Johnson, people remember, a lot of people projected him to go in the top half of the first round. He wound up going in the middle of the second round to the Arizona Cardinals. Played well last year when he got in there, but, you know, it did have some injury issues. And it's a wear and tear thing with the knee. After the ACL, he had to have what is the equivalent of a microfracture. They don't really do microfractures with football players anymore, but it's the equivalent of that. And if he has to have it redone, there's concern that his career would be over. Regardless, there's a wear and tear issue that makes people concerned that he's going to be a one contract guy. And so that's sort of where this was, is like, how long is this going to hold up? And so, you know, the way that doctors will grade these guys is, you know, people think it's just pass fail. It's not really that, you know, it's all right, well, I'm going to give him a grade where like, we'll green light taking him in the second round, not the first round, or the fourth round, not the first three rounds. And so you're looking at it like a sliding scale, and it's all risk assessment, right? Like, this is what happened with Max Crosby too. You know, if Max Crosby was traded for a fifth round pick, the Ravens aren't sending him back to the Raiders, you know, mm-hmm. But there's a risk assessment, you know, equation involved with all of this. And so, you know, I think on this one, it was at what point are you comfortable investing a resource in him? And, you know, I think it was interesting that it happened with the Raiders trading up at the top of the fourth round, because clearly the Raiders had a conversation, you know, overnight, Friday into Saturday, about the idea of trading up and picking him. They only traded up one spot, but trading up and picking him, and, you know, having that amount of time, you know, would obviously give you the chance to check in with your doctors and get another look at how they feel about it.
I want to get your thoughts real quick. We don't have to dive too deeply into it. Steelers taking Drew Aller from Penn State. What do you make of it? You know, 2 years ago, people thought he might be a top 10 pick.
Yeah.
And this past year, you know, you saw a lot of warts in his game.
You put another one in the pipeline, I think. You know, I know their hope is to get Aaron Rodgers back. My guess would be they get Aaron Rodgers back. But, you know, I think it's stocking the quarterback room, and it's giving Mike McCarthy a chance to work with a young guy who does have some tools. And there's no question he does have some tools. He's big. He's got a huge arm. And I think if you wanted to take the optimistic view of it, he was playing in an offense the last couple of years that was not a good fit for him. He played for Andy Kotelnicki, who had been the offensive coordinator at Kansas, who, you know, if you look, there's like a lot of movement in the offense, and it kind of requires a quarterback who's a little bit more of a, you know, timing, rhythm, move around, all that stuff. And I don't think it really fit the old school big pocket passer. Like, the name I've heard as a comp for Drew Aller over the last couple of years, even when people really liked him, was Drew Bledsoe. You know, he's like sort of that type of player. So I think if you want to take an optimistic view of it, you would look and say there are some really good pieces here, right? Like there are some really good traits here to work with. And, you know, maybe we get him in the room with Mike McCarthy. And Mike McCarthy, who people forget, like rebuilt Aaron Rodgers' delivery, you know, two decades ago. And maybe, you know, if there's something there to harvest, then Mike can dig in and find it.
All right. I got one final question for you, Bert. It's not pertaining to the draft. Pertains to the NFL replacement officials dilemma that's coming. I remember 2012. I remember that fail on Monday night between Green Bay and Seattle. And as a fan of the game, I am desperately hoping that we avoid a situation like that. Is the league and the officials, are they going to get any closer as the season comes? Or, you know, are the reports about the league preparing them? Are we headed for that?
I mean, deadlines generally like push things here. I would say like there are a couple of things to consider here. And the first is like, you know, the officials will be on the field at OTAs and mini camps. And so like the first opportunity for coaches and players to complain about the replacement officials is coming. The CBA, I believe, is up May 31st. I don't know how significant that is because these guys don't get paid until the summer anyway. There's still a lot of things that they're working through. I would imagine that everybody wants to avoid the disaster that this was. Like, I even forgot about how bad some of the stuff was. I think
so bad.
Someone had told me that, like, and I forgot about this one, but somebody told me like Jim Harbaugh wound up with like 7 challenges in one of the games or something like that. Like, so I think we all want to, I think everybody wants to avoid that. But I mean, I also think like the owners need to tread carefully with their tactics on these guys, because like when you're dealing with the players, you're dealing with their livelihood and guys who have a finite amount of time to make the money that they're making. And the rank and file players don't last very long. Mm-hmm. So like it's hard to get guys to withstand a work stoppage. This is totally different than that. These are guys who are successful in other businesses. A lot of doctors, lawyers, guys who work in finance, like a lot of these guys are highly successful in other fields. And so they 100% have the leverage to say, no, we're not going to do that. You know? And so it'll be interesting to see the way all of that plays out. But it's definitely a different dynamic than the player-owner negotiation.
I just can't do 2012 again. I can't do it. It was a laughing stock. I can't do it.
I kind of enjoyed it. I don't know.
That image is burned in my head on that Monday night game where you got him, one official with his arms up, single touchdown, the other one waving his arms.
Maybe if I was a gambler, I wouldn't have thought it was so funny, but it was pretty funny. I thought it was pretty good.
Well, Bert, thanks again for the great insight. Yeah. You're really generous with your time. I feel smarter already. Remember to check out all of Bert's great work on SI.com. You can listen to his podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can catch him on NBC Sports Boston, 98.5 The Sports Hub, and probably over the next several weeks doing a lot of chores around his house.
Yeah. I'll be at a lot of lacrosse games for the next 6 months.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Nice.
Dad duty for Bert.
And
that'll do it for this episode. Be sure to download us on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating if you're enjoying it. Subscribe to the YouTube channel and follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook as well. Please comment. Your feedback goes a long way to help us grow. And that'll do it for Burge. I'm Manish. Thanks again to Albert Breer for joining us.